Well, it's my job to introduce the last panel of this Philadelphia Society meeting, a panel devoted to what we see in America, observations on the essence of our culture. But since this is the wrap-up panel, I thought I would begin it by returning to our theme, namely the USA, an idea or a people. This panel is concerned with culture, with observations on the essence of American culture. But of course, that in a way begs the question, what is the essence of our culture? Is it an idea or a received way of life? Or perhaps a congeries of ways of life, as Forrest MacDonald emphasized this morning. Up to now, the emphasis in our discussions has been on the USA as a people. So let me say something about the USA as an idea. Without meaning to reject the empirical accounts of the founding and of the American people's mores in the late 18th century that were sketched so vividly this morning by Forrest MacDonald and Bernard Sheehan, I think we have to admit that although the Americans were a people to begin with, or at least however homogeneous or heterogeneous you wish to depict them, they still seem to amount, roughly speaking, to a people. Although the Americans were a people, they were a people that had an idea. And this idea was proclaimed in the Declaration of Independence and embodied in the Constitution. This was a people, after all, whose representatives staked their lives, fortunes, and sacred honor on behalf of these abstract principles proclaimed in the Declaration. They fought not merely for the rights of Englishmen, but, according to them, for the rights of man. I note that John O'Sullivan, who put such an emphasis on the rights of on America as a people, is himself an Englishman. And without suggesting a hidden agenda in his remarks, I would say that they might also have been entitled The Empire Strikes Back. So America began as a people with an idea, pledged to an idea. But it was then up to this idea to shape a people, to shape and sustain a people. Or to put it differently, it was up to this idea to shape a common culture that could uphold and vindicate our independence. Otherwise, we would have been stuck in the position which much of the Third World has been stuck in the 20th century, of something you might call neo-colonial dependency. That is, our economy tied to the former mother country, our culture tied to the former mother country, our literature and so forth, our religion, everything. But in declaring independence, political independence, America then had to turn to another great series of questions, how to establish, as it were, cultural independence. Now, culture is, of course, something that's cultivated, that's grown. But do you wish to grow flowers or weeds, trees or shrubs, annuals or perennials, beautiful ornamentals or useful vegetables? You can't judge a culture, in other words, or a people's way of life without some reference to the ends or the purposes you think it ought to serve, the principles that ought to organize it. And as we heard so eloquently just a moment ago from Ed Meese, Ronald Reagan's view was that the kind of people who could be Americans was a very special kind indeed. America, he said, in continuing a great tradition of American rhetoric, which used to be known as American exceptionalism, America, Reagan argued, was a promised land, which therefore required a chosen people to fill it up. Not just any people, not just a people, but a chosen people, which I think in our context means a people that has chosen an idea. Now, America's original cultural products or works of art, as Gary Wills noted some time ago, if I may mention the name of that apostate, America's original works of art were sermons and political pamphlets. Our novels, plays, short stories, poems, and so forth came later, and always were somehow derivative of our political ideas. Our literature somehow is always trying to flesh out those ideas, whether to endorse them or to improve them or to repudiate them. This is why I think the literature of the American frontier, for example, is so different from the literature of the Canadian or the Australian frontier, despite the British origins of the people who were filling up each of these continents. So what do we see in America today, then? That's the subject for our panel. What's the state of our culture, and what light does it shed on its essence, on the USA as an idea or a people? We have three distinguished guests to discuss these large and important questions. I'll introduce each one before he speaks. First is the redoubtable Arnold Bishman, no stranger to the Philadelphia Society, since he is a former vice president and trustee of our illustrious gathering. He is presently, and has been since 1982, a research fellow at the Hoover Institution in Stanford. He received his bachelor's, master's, and doctorate degrees in political science from Columbia University. Professor Bishman has taught at the University of Massachusetts, the University of British Columbia, the University of Calgary, and has been an adjunct professor at Georgetown. In addition to his distinguished teaching career, he has had an eminent career as a writer as well, contributing not only to academic and popular journals too numerous to name, but also he is the author of 5 books. Most recently, The Long Pretense, Soviet Treaty Diplomacy, 1917 to 1990, a scholarly history, and a recent reprint of an older edition of one of his books that was called 9 Lies About America. The reprint, with a new introduction, which is coming out, is out from Transactions Publishers, is retitled Anti-American Myths. I would say that the bad news about 9 Lies About America is that it's of continuing relevance, and these lies continue to be told. The good news is there are still only 9 of them. Arnold Bishman's topic this afternoon is Let's Stop Cringing. It's my pleasure to introduce Arnold Bishman.